I thought you rather sane for a Hingeman, said Mars. Not mindful of our prophet's teachings, but then you started life on the barren mountain, with no priest at hand, and your birth father rarely seen beneath your roof. His sins were not yours, and your brother Mektu's behavior, his disgraceful play-acting, his ugly ideas of mirth, none of this I ever thought to hold against you. But then this disgrace.
Greatly daring, he took one step toward Condri.
My task, he said, was to cleanse the girl, in keeping with our prophet's law. Anyone who claims I did else but that is a liar and an enemy, a stooge of blackest hell. Beg the father's pardon, wretch, growled one of the priests. Nay, not my own, said Mars. Let him beg the pardon of Ong Most High, in our holy prophet's name.
With that, he tottered away, and the priests trailed after him. The army captain lingered a moment, considering Condri almost wryly. What's to be done with me, sir? Asked Condri.
Get some rest, said the captain, starting away. I think you're going to need it.
The weeks that followed were the lowest Condri had ever known. There was his suspicion of Mektu, who visited him often in the cell, but who chattered in such a tactless manner that Condri often wished he would stay away. There was his fear for Arikina. How could she possibly manage such a journey on her own? There was the ache of her loss. A shard of glass lodged in his lungs, stabbing him with every breath. But worse than any of these was the lingering mystery. If Mars was telling the truth, and no one had harmed Arikina, what had made her flee into the night? Of course, his own fate, too, was waiting to be decided. Someone had heard the priest mutter,
10 years for Lantor Hingeman's brat.
10 years? He would be an unimaginable 30 by the time he stepped out of that cage, if the lice had not devoured him or killed him off with some disease. The simpleton made animal noises. Goats, cows, roosters, especially at night. Sometimes he rambled about friends Condri suspected were imaginary. The old murderer just watched him, small eyes bright under a shock of greasy gray hair. 10 years. Condri dared not contemplate such a sentence. But what else did he have to think about? What else but Ari's fate, Mektu's guilty expression, their mother soaking her sarong with tears? In desperation, he picked up the book from the army captain. It was called The Five Atrocities, and it described, in horrific detail, the crimes visited on the Chiloto people throughout history. There were far more than five, but the book began with an essay on the origins of the Chiloto clan, and that is where Condri found himself spellbound. It seemed his people were the first true kings of Uroth. They ruled the continent long before the slave-built empire of the Khosraj, before the still earlier kingdom of Utzing the Conqueror, before even the ancient Sartafs, the builders of stone cities long since drowned in desert sands. But none of these were instructive. For the Chilotos, the book explained, had built a different kind of kingdom, one not of masters and servants, but the natural fealty paid by a grateful continent. They had treated all peoples with justice, defended the weak against the strong, lifted the poor from their misery, built schools, consecrated temples. Under their stewardship, all clans had prospered. Few, if any, had seen a reason to resist, for it was clear that this arrangement was better than any feasible alternative. Some clans were born to grow wheat, or brew palm wine, or quarry stone. The Chilotos were born to rule other clans and help them forward into the light of Ong. This might seem strange today, but in the beginning, everyone understood. The conquered peoples thanked the gods for their rulers. On the fringes of the empire, clans begged the monarchs to enter their lawless territories and plant the Chiloto flag. Condri's ancestors, the book continued, were also the most learned people of the ancient world. They had invented matches, windlasses, bore wells, cotton fabric, leavened bread, fiddles, oil paints, arithmetic, astrology, stoneware, steel. Princes from foreign lands came to learn the secrets of the Chilotos, for the plague would not appear for centuries, and apprenticed their sons to the clan's master craftsmen. The Chiloto, open-hearted, shared their knowledge gladly, with no thought of recompense. But they learned to their sorrow that not all the world's clans were so benevolent. One day Mektu burst shouting into the jailhouse.
You're to be pardoned tomorrow! I heard them! Mars is willing to forget the whole thing!
Condri jumped up with his heart in his mouth, but Mektu had not come during visiting hours and was driven roughly away. Tomorrow came and went, and the next day, and the next. Diakra Hingeman told him to keep his chin up.
Lantor is negotiating. He's sure to cut some sort of deal.
Her words did not reassure him. The old man was the last person who should be pleading his case to Father Mars. The two men were enemies, and rivals of a sort. Both were considered men of influence, but their beliefs and instincts could not have differed more.
Seppu, said Condri, resorting to the name she'd given herself the day they met. Would you talk to old Mars? Could you, please?
His second mother was, without question, the gentlest soul he had ever known, a fact that made her response all the more startling. She looked away from him, gazed fixedly at the small, clouded window at the end of the hall. She hugged herself, washtub rough hands enfolding knobby elbows.
If I must, she said, but that should be the last thing we try. Your father is dramatic, yes. Mektu gets it from him. Still, Lantor can keep his cool with Father Mars. I manage as well, Ong knows, in the street, at the festivals.
She rose, straightened her sarong, making to leave although she had arrived just minutes before.
But leave me in a room alone with that man, and only one of us will come out alive.
The next day, Diakra told him that Mektu had given up the search. He had gone instead to work at the clinic, but the nurses had sent him home because his compulsive spewing of mawkish poetry was upsetting the patients. Condri was far more curious about his father's secret, but somehow he knew that he must respect the old man's admonition, if not forever, at least for a time. Nor did he dare ask his second mother about her hatred of the priest. She had walked out once already, and he looked forward to her visits more than he liked to admit. She also brought him bread, sometimes fresh from the oven, with a white knob of butter melting inside. So, a safe topic of conversation. He told his mother that he really did love Arikina. She nodded.
I know that. You always have, and I hate their sense of humor.
Whose? Said Condri, sitting up.
Are people making jokes about her? Not people. The gods. They make jokes of us all. Very cruel and senseless jokes.
Well, there's nothing funny about it, said Condri, confused.
She loved me too, Mother. Loves, I mean. All Mektu's talk about a secret engagement is just his craziness.
Good, she said brightly.
There's a bit of mercy, anyway.
You and Papa don't like her much, do you?
Where in Ong's name did you get that idea?
Asked his mother.
We love Arikina. Both of us.
Condri studied her a moment. She was smiling, but her eyes were moist, and she would not look at him directly. She was, he thought, more upset than the day they spoke about the priest.
I hope you do, he said carefully, because one day I'm going to make her your daughter-in-law.
Oh, she said, popping from the chair as if a spring had been released.
Oh, my, that's extraordinary. What a beautiful young man you are, Condri. Goodbye.
Days became weeks. The negotiations had evidently failed. One of the guards began to demand half of everything Condri's family brought him. When Condri refused, the man reported that Condri had lunged at him at mealtime, and in punishment he was denied all visitors for a month. The guard also confiscated all the books Condri's family had brought to him to fill the empty hours. all save the 5 atrocities, which Condrey had by now read forward and backward. His beard grew long. He paced the cell like an animal. When the month ended at last, his father brought 7-year-old Perch, his baby brother, to visiting hours. In the corridor, the same guard frisked Lantor Hingeman, then crouched before the child, who was sucking his forefinger.
"Are you a good boy? Do you say your prayers each night? Or are you another lout like your brother in there? He smells bad, you know."
The boy took the finger from his mouth and poked him hard in the eye. Condrey and the old man broke into unfortunate laughter. Perch howled and put his head on the floor. The simpleton began to rub his genitals, and visiting hours were canceled until the spring. On his 81st day of incarceration, the guard delivered half a sugar cake from Diakra Hingeman and a letter from Nereti. His elder sister, who had never visited, informed him tersely that Chima had won a maths competition, that the yellow hound had killed a neighbor's goose, that his father had made something explode in his workshop, and that Ong All-Merciful would very certainly be sending you to hell. Condrey wolfed down the cake, then turned the page over. "But in the meantime, it appears you shall go free." Once more his heart leapt. Surely this time the nightmare was ending. He waited until sundown. No one came. Through the long night that followed, he stared at the ceiling, sleepless, thinking of Arikina and the city of Kasralis, wondering who would sell him a horse. The next morning he sat against the bars, where he could see a slice of the corridor. He was so exhausted that he dozed, and when he woke, he felt a warm pressure against his shoulder. Mektu sat outside the cell, wide awake but slumped in almost the same posture, hands folded on his legs.
"Imagine," he said abruptly, "all of us out here going on with our lives, visiting you, of course, but not able to change anything, watching you rot in there for years, watching you get older, stiffer, like some animal forgotten in a cage."
"Thanks for cheering me up," said Condrey.
Mektu's eyes were distant. "It's all right, brother," he said. "I'm at peace with it now."
"You're at peace?" said Condrey.
"Mech, just tell me what's going on. Nereti says I'm to go free."
"Is that how she put it?"
Footsteps echoed in the corridor. Condrey pressed his face to the bars, saw the two men approaching, saw the deal they had struck as if it were written in the air.
"No, Mech," he whispered.
"Hell no. Get rid of them, please."
But Mektu just sat there, eyes sad and knowing.
10 years is too long, Con," he said.
The first man was their father. The second was the army captain who had lent him the book. The choice was simple. Enlistment for both brothers, and a clean record, all charges dropped. Or likely conscription for Mektu within the year. Valley youths were next on the army's list, the captain confided, and for Condrey, 12 years in jail.
12?
The captain nodded.
"Our discussions with Father Mars were not without incident."
The old man looked away. Condrey stared at his father's bald patch. 12 years in this box. 12 years of lice and hunger, frigid nights, howling dogs. 12 years without Arikina, without even the sensible hope that he could find her. There was no choice. He was caught like a rabbit in a snare. But Mektu?
"Leave my brother out of this," he said to the captain. "I'll enlist. I'll do whatever you want, but not with him."
The old man shook his head.
"The captain and I have been over this, Condrey. For days."
"Maybe you don't get along. Need a break from each other," says the captain.
"Not to worry. We're used to that. We can assign you to different units."
"No!"
cried Mektu.
"No,"
said Condrey.
"That's not the point."
"What is the point, son?" "Mektu knows what he's getting into. Corporal Batali's letters made sure of that. He's healthy, he's quick, he's strong as a mountain lion."
"He's a dunce," said Condrey. "A dreamer. He loves this idiotic verse. You can't make a soldier out of someone like him."
Mektu's upper lip curled in rage. Before he could spit out a retort, the officer began to laugh.
"I've made soldiers of worse," he said.
Condry looked at him helplessly.
"No, you haven't."
"And volunteers get better appointments," said the captain. "You'll see less combat than the boys we drag kicking and screaming. When you sign, we'll hand your mother a nice little purse. And you, Condry, when you return to the valley one day, you'll ride in like a man with full honors. Serve 12 years in here, and you'll crawl out pale and feeble. A washed-up bum no woman will look at, no mother speak of with pride. Is that the life for a man like you?"
Man, thought Condry. He was not certain he merited the word.
"It was the best I could do, Condry," said his father. "I'm sorry."
"Sorry!"
said the captain, suddenly irate.
"What is it with you Hingemans? The Prophet is offering you much more than a way out of prison."
His eyes fixed on Condry.
"Did you read that book?"
Condry took a deep breath. He nodded.
"Show me."
Condry retrieved the book and tried to pass it through the bars. The captain shook his head.
"Well thumbed. Excellent. All I wanted to see."
He leaned closer, holding Condry with his gaze.
"Her radiance needs you, Hingeman. The Vajeks are still on our doorstep. What you read in that book is still happening to our people in the north. If we grow lazy, it will be happening here again by the moon's next quarter. Your sisters, your little brother, your second mother who loves you more than life itself, they will be dead. You understand me, son? Dead, or worse than that in the case of the girls, if men like you say no. And it won't end with our defeat. This is a war to save the Choloto people, of course, but it's also a war for the salvation of Uroth. I won't lie. It will be rough. You and your brother will know sheer misery at times. But that's the way of the world, Hingeman. Only the dead are free from pain. Those who hide from pain end up hiding from life, cowering behind the strong, until even their own kin have no use for them. They wither, like grass under a rock. They betray their own souls.
He looks the boys over again.
That's the key to all of this, my boys. The Prophet needs the strength of our arms, but she asks for something much greater. She asks us to give our souls. And in return, she makes our souls, like our bodies, stronger than all the pain in this world.
He spoke with such obvious sincerity that Condry's scornful retorts died on his lips. Mektu looked at the captain, wide-eyed. The speech was new to him as well. Their father gazed at the grimy floor.
"Are you ready for a new life, Mr. Hingeman?" asked the captain.
Condry shook his head, but only slowly, as though he were struggling in a vat of glue. The captain smiled. He reached into his coat pocket and produced a key.
"The jailers entrusted me with this," he said. "And I trust you. Don't make me regret it. You're no runner, are you? Not a piss-yellow coward who would take this and flee?"
Once again, as if it were his only trick, Condry shook his head.
"Good," said the captain, extending his hand through the bars. "I'll be here until the end of the week."
They left, his brother and father murmuring goodbyes. Condry stood alone in the dim morning light, in one hand the book of atrocities, in the other the key to his cell.
27 is finished. Apulu Basat. 27 is complete.
Condry leaped from the chair. The voice is Dr. Scaris's, bellowing from some adjacent room. Other voices answer, sharp and excitable, none of them in a language he understands. Green light fills the room beyond the window. Half a dozen Zavacindrans are dashing from one doorway to another, debating anxiously. One or two glance up at Condry as though startled to find him still in the building. Elsewhere, doors slam and boots thump down corridors. Some kind of strident mechanical bell begins to ring. The piano player continues his performance, like a man deranged. Click, whoosh. The door to the front room opens, and the nurse rushes in.
"Who the hell do you people think you are?" says Condry. "I was locked in here like a dog."
The nurse has lost a good deal of her composure.
"You must come with me now," she says.
"Where's my brother, damn you?"
"The procedure is concluded. 27 will be returned to you. Oh, hurry, brother escort, please."
"Returned to me? Alive or in a fucking box?" She crosses to the far door, not glancing once at the wreckage of the room. Condry follows, biting back another outburst. They enter a narrow hallway. The green lamps in the ceiling flicker. Two neatly uniformed sentries march by at an intersection, spears in hand. At the hallway's end, she opens another door, seizes his elbow, pulls him swiftly through.
"Condry! Oh, gods, Mech!"
Condry rushes forward. Mektu is standing in the room's center, fully dressed, beaming. Dr. Skaris is at his side, squinting at a thermometer. The brothers embrace.
"Careful!"
snaps the doctor.
27 is not to stretch or twist for a week."
He is wearing a pale green smock. Alone of all the Zavacindrans, he seems untouched by panic, indifferent to the strident mechanical bell. High on his forehead is a strange brass eyepiece held with a strap. A drop of blood glistens on the lens.
"I'm healed, brother! Look!"
Mektu raises his shirt, and Condry finds himself almost in tears. The swelling is gone, the flesh already returning to a healthier color. Black stitches, fine as needlework, close both the entry and exit wounds. Ong is merciful. Tabassa has not betrayed them.
"Your brother is fortunate to be alive," says Skaris.
"The infection had spread downward into the lining of the intestines." He glances irritably at Condry.
"Those are tubes, if you like. Very important tubes."
The brothers exchange a look.
"We've seen them, Doctor," says Condry.
"On the battlefield."
"They must be treated with the greatest care," says Skaris.
"And that is how I treated them, Brother Escort, despite your howls and yammers. My work was impeccable. If I had not intervened, he would have died within a week. If you please, nurse."
He moves to a wash basin, and the nurse, frantic, bustles to his side.
Condry starts to babble his thanks, but the doctor cuts him off.
"Impeccable does not mean perfect, you understand. When disease has intruded this far into a body, not even Zavacindran medicine can guarantee its total removal."
The nurse pours water over his hands, pats them dry with a towel. Condry sees that her own hands are trembling.
"As a precaution," says the doctor, "I have left a benign resin inside the wound. The substance kills putrefaction, but is quite harmless otherwise. Eventually his body will dissolve the resin into the blood."
He removes the eyepiece from his forehead, frowns at the spot of blood.
"I expect no complications, provided you behave yourself, 27. No hard labor, no horseplay or running or the like. That wound must not reopen."
The nurse tugs at his arm, speaks in a whisper that verges on a squeal. Skaris responds with a noncommittal grunt.
"Doctor?" says Mektu. "What is it, 27? "In school they taught us that every Urathi carries the plague inside, like a seed. Is that true?"
"Nearly all, yes," says Skaris. "It resides in the tissue of the lungs."
"Then are you risking your own lives by coming here to fight it?"
"Not at all," says Skaris, still bustling with his tools. "Among Urathis, as I told you, roughly one soul in 8,000 is susceptible to the plague. In the outer world there is a mirror phenomenon. One in 8,000 or so is immune. Only those rare few may apply to join the Zavacindrans. As you can observe, most of us belong to the same clan."
"A yellow-skinned clan?"
"Obviously. Kvinuks, we call ourselves."
"And do Kvinuks get the plague caught in their lungs like we do? Are you a danger to your own people when you return?"
Skaris, struck by the question, turns to look at him at last.
"We are a danger," he says. "And for that reason, we too are quarantined, on an island in the middle of the sea. We remain there in small cottages, keeping apart even from each other. We test ourselves weekly, inhale astringents, cough into tubes. Gradually our lungs eliminate the spore. When we pass 5 tests in sequence, we are declared plague-free and may board the next ship for home.
How long does this process keep you stuck there? Asks Condry.
3 years, normally, but in some cases as many as 12.
12 years? You'd give 12 years of your life to fight the plague.
If necessary.
I hope you're well paid, at least, says Condry. Are you, if you don't mind me asking?
But Scaris does mind, apparently. He turns his back on them again.
The clerk will return your weapons in the vestibule, provided you have not lost your coin.
Minutes later, they are standing in the same long, windowless alley where they took leave of Stilts. The iron door clangs shut behind them, and the warmth of late afternoon bathes their skin. Mab McCootin. Even in this sterile alley, he can smell her cook fires, her rubbish and latrines. It is like returning to Uroth from some cold foreign netherworld. A world they could destroy just by breathing on it. A world they'll never see. Mektu straps his machete to his belt.
You should let me keep that, says Condry. You'll forget and tear your stitches, and then Eshet will kill you.
Mektu shakes his head.
I won't forget. And I still want people to think I'm dangerous.
You damn well are. The brothers lock eyes, then burst out laughing, stupid with relief. Mektu has just stepped back from a cliff.
Mech, says Condry. Those tools of theirs, those lights. What in Jekka's hell are they?
That cold, says Mektu, shaking his head.
Exactly, the cold. Not even the old man could explain that. Are they magicians? They seem more like tinkers, mechanics. I don't know what.
Brother, can the whole outer world be full of those people, those tools, while we're stuck here inside the quarantine like pigs in a pen?
Noises in the distance. A wash of shouts and bellows. A crash. The nicker of a horse.
I really think we should leave, says Mektu.
They rush down the alley. It is hours past noon. They will have no time for a proper rest at Yehida's farmhouse. Perhaps, thinks Condry, they can at least wolf down a meal, stretch out for 5 minutes on the good woman's floor, watch the dog and the chickens, pretend for a moment that the world still makes sense.
The cries grow louder.
A fight's broken out, says Mektu. Bit early for drunks, isn't it?
Mech, says Condry.
What were you shouting for when they took you away?
Mektu's glance is confused.
I didn't shout, he says.
The hell you didn't?
No, please, take it away. You scared me out of my pants.
Condry, says Mektu,
I didn't shout. They gave me some kind of liquor, and it made me sleep. I never felt a thing.
Condry stops in his tracks. A vague dread, like a scream from some locked and distant chamber, is stealing over him. The voice was Mektu's, of that he has no doubt. What is happening? Can his brother be lying again? He glances over his shoulder at the cold iron door. But the medical mission is sealed like a fortress. The Zavacindrans are finished with them. At the mouth of the alley, something gleams on the cobbles. Condry peers at the dark red puddle.
Jashar, that's fresh blood.
Charming, says Mektu. Turn right. For 3 blocks they walk in silence. A boy sprints past them, a worried-looking dog at his heels. They see more blood, this time a smeared handprint on a whitewashed door. All the while the distant shouts crash and echo, waves among rocks. Condry is impressed by his brother's calm. Perhaps the drug has not quite worn off? How useful to have a supply of that, something you could, every so often, slip into his tea.
Mektu jumps with great violence.
Hurrah! Cries Condry.
What's the matter? Stepped on a nail?
Oh, gods, says Mektu.
Your stitches? Your wound?
No, gods, shit!
Mektu!
We're dead, Condry! Flaming shit!
Mektu, talk to me.
The man who was watching you. With the beard. We damned well have seen him before. He's the third tier muscle. The one Atau left behind with the camel when we descended that ridge.
No, says Condry.
No way in hell. That man's beard was black and white, like a skunk. He must have dyed it, Con. It's him. Think. You know it is.
Oh, fuck. The mouth, the forehead. Mektu is right. And the man fled from the marketplace like wolves were at his heels. Or like a man about to earn the prize of a lifetime, if only he can run fast enough to claim it. But run to whom?
You never listen, says Mektu. I told you, didn't I? We should have just gotten out of here.
They quicken their pace. Bells are ringing in some temple or tower, anxious and discordant. Convry tries to reverse the steps that brought them to the Zavacindrans, but the task proves hopeless. They have entered the city in the gray light of dawn. Now the day is ending, and the shadows are long and black. The streets meander. All the smooth white walls look alike. There are people about, but they are wary and in haste, some running with armloads of vegetables, others dragging children by the hand. One man carries an old woman on his back, frail as a hatchling. Another locks a chain around a gate. Quite a few people steal glances at the sky, as though wondering how long they have before the night closes in. The shouts and cries grow nearer. Is this the tailor's district they passed in the morning? Condry thinks so, but Mektu says they are still too far south. At last, Condry collars a street vendor pushing his cart of limes at a run and demands directions to the dawn gate. The man waves frantically, rattles off lefts and rights. His headscarf trails a yard of muslin. A bruise discolors his cheek. What's all the brawling about? Condry demands.
Brawling? Cries the man. Is that what you'd call it?
Before the brothers can answer, a high, murderous yowl echoes along the street. The vendor flees, abandoning his wares. Condry, in a horror of recognition, grabs Mektu and pulls him down behind the cart. At that very instant, an enormous gray Sivkrin appears at the corner. On its back rides a Rasanga. The prophet's commando holds a long spear, 5 feet of which are dark with gore. The big cat snarls again. Condry hugs his brother ferociously, a hand clamped over his mouth. The cart is barely large enough to hide them both. They do not breathe. Beyond the cart's edge, the long shadows of rider and mount stretch toward them. Condry can almost feel them debating which way to turn. Then a second mounted shadow appears beside the first. Mektu looks like a horse in a lightning storm, wild with fear. Condry mashes their cheeks together, closing his eyes. We can't beat them. We can't outrun them. If they come this way, we die. If you make a scene, we die. But his brother is as still as marble, and the Rasanga pass on. They get up. Condry's limbs are shaking.
They're here for us, Mech, he says. Someone's tipped them off. A Tau's man, says Mektu. Who else? Old Skunkbeard must have sent word north to the 7th Legion, or ridden there himself like the wind. But how many can there be?
An excellent question. The 7th Legion is 12,000 strong, but it is not a mounted legion, and no foot soldiers could have reached Mab Makutin so swiftly. Condry looks at his brother. They must have a special detachment. Riders, I mean.
They have 86 horsemen, says Mektu. You're making that up. The hell I am. 86 Shessel and 4 Rasanga with sandcats. We had a cooking order last month. We smoked meat for the 7th.
All right. 90 riders. Condry blinks, dizzy with fear. But they wouldn't send all 90, would they? And even if they did, it's not enough to assault the city. So what the fuck are they up to?
Maybe they didn't come from the north, says Mektu. Maybe they're what's left of the wolf pack that chased us across the stolen sea.
In which case, there's even fewer of them, says Condry. But his words bring no comfort. They have killed men of that wolf pack with the help of Ornak vultures. Those left alive have even more blood to avenge. They move on, no longer seeking the avenue, clinging to the darker streets. Many others are doing the same. By the next block, they have joined a stream of frightened men and women rushing the gods nowhere. The white homes give way to the taller, darker hulks of old warehouses and counting houses, relics of the city of fisherfolk. By what he gleaned from the vendor's babble, Condry thinks they must be close to the dawn gate. But is there any hope of exiting there?
If even a dozen of the Prophet's forces have reached the city, surely every gate will be watched.
A Tau.
One man, one greedy coward. But his malice still clung to them, even after his death. And what if the black-bearded Tirmasol found an accomplice? Some common grafter, paid to dog their heels all the way to the old woman's farmhouse. Chindalin and Eshet and the girl might already be...
Shut up. Keep moving. Get your brother out of here alive.
There, dead ahead, is the wall at last. The dawn gate is just visible, a few blocks farther north. The bells they've been hearing are in the turrets to either side. The avenue is crowded and jostling, but the heart of the turmoil is at the gate itself. When they reach the wall, Condry sees that its inner face has been abandoned more fully to the ravages of time. Vines sprouting everywhere, stones cracked and fallen, planks bridging gaps in the walkway under the parapet. But the sentries, armed and numerous, are on duty all the same. Condry pulls his brother back into an alcove.
We can't let them see us either, he says. They may be under attack, but that doesn't mean they won't hand us over. For all we know, they're seeking us desperately.
We still have to get through that gate, says Mektu.
True enough, but around the gate the crowd is roaring. They wait until the nearest sentry's back is turned, then dash for the next hiding place. The doorway of yet another grand, decrepit warehouse. From here the gate is hidden, but they can see most of the plaza before it. The crowd is hundreds strong. Townsfolk, mostly. Young men with machetes and clubs. But at the vanguard stands a large detachment of sentries. To Condry's surprise, they look rather formidable, with their ringmail and lowered spears. He cannot decide whether that is good news or bad. Mektu taps his shoulder. The door behind them is unlocked. They slip unseen into the dark of the warehouse, drawing the door shut behind them. The building is abandoned, hollowed out, reeking of bird dung and mold. Although its shell is stone, the interior is all wood and has not fared well. The high, vaulted ceiling has mostly collapsed, affording dim views of a second story. Cries and bellows from the street echo weirdly around them.
Useless, says Mektu. They've bricked the windows over.
Condry points through the gaping hole.
Not up there, they haven't. Find a staircase. I want to know what the hell's going on.
The staircase is a horror. The framing beams long since plundered, the treads rotting out.
No climbing for you, says Condry. Stay here. Watch the door for me.
I'll be fine, says Mektu.
Damn right you will. Watch the fucking door.
The staircase sags like a hammock as Condry climbs, first gingerly, then in a wild scramble as he feels the structure yearning to give way. With a last sickening bounce, he gains the second story. But the floor here is equally terrifying, a crust around a gaping hole, the planks flexing and sinking like piano keys underfoot. Hugging the wall, he makes his way to the building's north face and crawls the last few yards to the window. Carefully, a turtle from a shell, he lifts his head above the sash. The dawn gate is closed. Under the great red arch, the doors of latticed iron have been swung into place and crossed with two beams of steel. The beams are clearly a latter-day addition to the defenses. They look strong, if rather crude, beside the majesty of the older structures. Two enormous locks secure them to the turrets flanking the dawn gate. A battering ram might rip them from the old stone, but nothing lesser would. Hundreds of sentries and a like number of townsfolk cluster near the gate. Outside, soldiers of Revelation are milling about on horseback. They are indeed Shessel, riders like those who accompanied Garatajic, and one of them holds aloft the standard of the 7th Legion.
It is true, then. These men have ridden from the Arikoro front in the north. The riders are shouting, gesticulating, demanding entrance. Some have knocked arrows to bows. Among them, Condry sees but one Rasanga, a huge woman upon a caterwauling Sivkrin. How did the others enter the city? Did they storm another gate, or fight their way in before these iron doors could be closed? And why are so many people glancing up at the sky?
Condry creeps to the east side of the building. Here he can see a longer stretch of the wall. Yes, the inner side has been let go.
In some places, the stone and masonry have collapsed in piles to the street, like shards of an eroding cliff. The sky above the wall is a dark, bruised orange. Already he can see a few early stars.
"Brother! Hurrah!"
Khandri nearly jumps out of his skin. Mektu has climbed the stairs and crept to his elbow.
"Damn your sneaky ass! I told you to wait! Brother, quickly, come and see."
Mektu leads him back to the windows overlooking the square. Down the long avenue, a second mob is approaching. Like the first, it is a mix of townsfolk and soldiers, but many of the latter are riding the lean, high-stepping horses of the Lutaral. And at the heart of the procession is a breathtaking creature, enormous, slate-gray, with ears like torn flags and a nose like a beheaded python.
"That's an elephant," says Mektu. "That's Talupeke's elephant. Vuseku, wasn't it?"
"Vuseku," says Khandri, nodding.
"That thing could kill a Sivkrin with a toss of its head."
The animal is draped in finery and foil armor. Its tusks are painted a brilliant aquamarine and capped with gold. Two handlers with iron goads sit astride its shoulders, and behind them, upon a crimson saddle, rides the Ursaad of Mab Makutin. He has not gone to fat, as Mektu imagined. On the contrary, he is large and imposing, with straight black locks, a neat spade of a beard, and a bright shield with a version of the old imperial bull embossed at its center. Under his right arm is a simple spear, like those wielded by his guards. The crowd at the gate falls back, making room for the city's master. The soldiers outside merely wait. As he reaches the center of the square, the Ursaad lifts a hand. The procession stops. The bells fall silent. The shouting dies away. The Ursaad gazes down at the soldiers of the Prophet. Then he reaches beneath his tunic and draws out a brass key. It is nearly as long as his forearm.
"I think you hope for this," he says. "But you shall not have it, animals. You stand at the gate of Mab Makutin, and here just one man's word is law. We have been pleased to make common cause with your prophet these several years, but today you have marred that friendship, and we do not soon forget. I warn you now, withdraw."
The crowd roars, shaking weapons above their heads. Outside the gate, the soldiers of Revelation make no response at all. The Ursaad waits, looking somewhat at a loss. Once more he raises his hand.
"To come thus, demanding, threatening," he says, "to smuggle killers on hellcats into our midst, to shed our blood upon our very streets. Think well on what you do here, little instigators. Your prophet will not reward you for squandering the love between us."
Once more the crowd erupts. Khandri winces, closing his eyes. "The love between us. Gods, man, you don't understand her at all." The roaring lasts. Suddenly the lone Rasanga swings to the ground, tosses the Sivkrin's lead to one of the riders, and walks up to the iron bars. When she turns her head, Khandri sees four livid, parallel scars at an angle across her cheek, like something a bear might inflict. The warrior stands there, enduring the howls and heckles of the townsfolk, and even a few rocks that clang against the iron bars. At last the Ursaad himself calls for silence, and the crowd obeys.
"The Enlightened One," says the Rasanga, "has not sent me here to bargain or to beg. The twin abominations must die. Unlock this gate. We will find them and be gone. Oppose us further, and it will not go well for you this night."
"I have 2,000 soldiers, woman," snaps the Ursaad. "You will need something more than 30 horsemen and 5 braggarts on Sivkrin to back up your threats."
"I do have something more," says the Rasanga. "And I do not threaten, I inform. Ursaad, can you not sense prophecy at work? Look at the sky. Listen to the murmur of your people. They proclaim what you yourself fear to admit. The time of madness approaches. Would you hasten it? Would you be the spark that sets this town ablaze?"
Rubbish and lies, says the Ersad. The fate of Mab Makutan is her own. You will not frighten us with children's tales.
This time there is far less cheering. Quite a number of the townsfolk make surreptitious blessing gestures. The Ersad clears his throat.
What exactly do you want? He says. Speak plainly. We do not care for mysticism here.
You will surrender the abominations, says the Rasanga.
Or you will not, and all the same they will be found. Which path do you choose?
Abominations, says the Ersad. I tell you, we know not of what you speak, and we harbor no enemies of the prophet in Mab Makutan. That is a further insult.
Open the gate, says the Rasanga. Every moment you delay heaps more misery upon your people.
Do you bear no scroll or letter from your prophet woman? I will entertain a missive if it bears her seal.
No time, says the Rasanga. Our orders came on wings. Open the gate, you nattering fool. This is the last time I shall—
Her head snaps to the right. Someone has thrown a rock, which by ill luck has passed through the bars and struck her face, right on the cheek with the scars. Cries of fury behind her. The cavalry urge their horses up to the gate, but the Rasanga lifts a hand to still them. A stripe of blood runs from cheek to collarbone, but she shows no sign of pain. In utter silence, she gazes at the Ersad and his guard. Then she turns and walks away. The brothers look at each other, and for once the understanding between them is perfect.
Let's get the hell out of here, says Condri.
Wish I'd thought of that.
No point in checking the other gates, Condri says, ignoring the jab. We'll have to go over the wall. He looks sharply at Mektu. Without climbing, or mixing you up with a fight.
Climb without climbing, Mektu gives a snort of despair. I didn't say climb, I said go over. We can do it if we get our hands on some rope. Tie you a loop to sit in, brace the rope on the parapet, lower you down.
How do you plan to get me up there to begin with?
Where the hell would I have gotten a plan? Condri, what did you do for all those hours? Says Mektu. Were you daydreaming? Thinking about that nurse's ass?
Movement below. The prophet's soldiers are falling back. The townsfolk roar and jeer. For a moment, Condri can see no one beyond the gate, only the well-trodden earth, and a yellow butterfly stitching back and forth between the bars as though flaunting its freedom. The mob falls silent. A small figure is approaching the gate from the outside. It is a child, a girl, so thin and slight that a stiff wind could almost bear her away. She might be 11 or 12, stands no higher than a man's elbow. Her eyes are famished, her hair long and filthy. She wears a tattered gown that drags in the dust. Although ragged, the gown is lace-laden and frilled, the attire of a half-starved child bride. But that is not what stops the crowd from breathing. Every bit of the girl, hands, face, lips, hair, is white. Not pale, white. The hard white of marble, the submarine white of a fish's belly, the cold, bright white of the moon. Both men recoil, dropping below the window sash. Mektu grabs his brother's arm.
What the living honest fuck is that?
Condri forces himself to look again. The tiny girl has reached the gate. She pauses, gazing up at the ancient stone. All at once, Condri feels what he felt in Eternity Camp, in the octagonal courtyard with the palanquin, a flood of guilt and terror closing over his head.
The white child, he says. Some kind of devil, says Mektu. It is, isn't it? Why would they bring it here?
The girl lowers her chin, looks straight at the Ersad, and now Condri sees that her eyeballs are not white, but exactly the opposite, a solid, lustrous black. When she blinks, the blackness vanishes a moment under luminous eyelids. The effect is somehow obscene. Turning sideways, the girl passes one arm through the bars, then one leg.
The squeeze is tight, but she manages, gown and all. Once through, she walks without hesitation toward the sentries. Atop his elephant, the Ersad forces out a laugh.
What is this? So you have a freak of nature in your keeping? Do you think we are peasants to frighten into submission? Hold that creature at spear point, men of the guard.
But the guard, it seems, is afflicted by the same terror Condri feels. The man directly in the child's path falters first, sidling backward against his comrades. Others follow suit, and then the whole crowd is parting, as if they cannot bear the scrutiny of those eyes. Many look ashamed of their cowardice, yet still they retreat. Horses begin to nicker and prance. Only the elephant is still. The Ersad barks at his men. As though shaken from a dream, 10 or 12 leap forward and point their spears at the girl. But once more, something breaks in them. Spears droop, and soldiers step backward, grimacing with fear and shame. Now the girl stands before the elephant, looking absurdly small. That trunk could lift her like a weed. Those painted tusks could break her every bone. Gazing at the Ersad, she lifts a stick-like arm, hands spread wide as though begging for alms.
"The key!" shouts the Rasanga from the gate. "Surrender it, Ersad! There is no other way!"
"Why do you stand there?" shouts the Ersad at his men. "Drive her off! If she resists, stake her body to the earth!"
The child hisses at the Ersad. With a spastic motion, the captain of the guard leans forward and jabs at the child with his spear. The girl's only response is to lower her hand to the elephant's leg. At her touch, a violent shudder passes through the animal. It throws its head back, lifts its trunk to heaven, and dies. The front legs buckle. The men on its back are pitched like dice into the street. The animal topples forward, tusks scraping the cobbles, and falls with a leaden boom onto its side. Absolute panic ensues. The guard scatters. The townsfolk stampede. One of the elephant's handlers has been crushed under the creature's shoulder. The other is trampled by the mob. Two guards rush to lift the Ersad, bloodied and barely conscious, but when they see the child approaching, they simply drop him and flee. Condri and Mektu kneel by the window, gasping and swearing. Mektu is the first to come to life.
"Get up! Move!"
Condri lets his brother haul him to his feet. They edge around the broken floor.
"Wait, wait,"
hisses Condri, astonished at himself.
"Like hell! Get your ass up!"
"Mech, this could be it. Our only chance."
"Chance?
She's going to take that key to the Rasanga. They're going to open the gate and charge in, searching for us. But they won't expect us to be right here, will they?"
"You said we had to go over the wall."
"Maybe not," says Condri. "Maybe we can just slip out." He drags Mektu back to the window. The Ersad's body lies face down in the plaza beside his elephant. The white child is pawing at his clothes.
"Your stitches," says Condri. "You're not supposed to run."
"Well, fuck that up and down."
"Just be as careful as you can.
Please, brother, I want you to live." The child has found the enormous key. She rises, holding it with both hands, and starts to walk toward the gate. The Rasanga stands waiting, stretching her hand through the bars. Behind her, the Shessel's stallions nicker and prance. 6 feet from the gate, the white child stops walking. Her head lifts, searching. It is as if she has been startled by an odor or a noise somewhere. The Rasanga calls out, but the girl ignores her. Extremely slowly, she turns around. Her black eyes fix on the warehouse. The key falls from her hand. She tilts her head, listening, fascinated. Her lips move as though she is sounding out words. Then she speaks, and the voice is the same little girl's voice Condri heard from the palanquin in Eternity Camp. And that is bad enough. But what she says... Gods of death, what she says. It is just one word. Impossible. Ludicrous. Depraved. The brothers look at each other again, and once more Khandri sees his own feelings mirrored in Mektu's face. Denial. A total incapacity to believe. The Rasanga gropes for the key with her sword. Then the child starts to walk toward the warehouse, and horror takes them so completely that they cannot even gasp. They just run. The staircase cracking and shattering as they slide down its length. The door sticking horribly, the door stuck fast, and every lower window bricked. Tears of horror on Mektu's face, tears in Khandri's own eyes. What the fuck? What in the pits? Until they remember that the door swings outward, not in, and they fling it wide and burst into the street. She is there, 10 paces away, her flesh aglow like white embers. She lifts both hands and smiles, and her mouth, like her eyes, is a black hole as she speaks the word again. Khandri surrenders any thought but flight from this nightmare. He runs with his arm around Mektu, trying to steady him, expecting to smell the blood of a reopened wound, crying uncontrollably, although he can't say why. Do any wounds heal? Is evil done ever truly erased? And what was it, Papa? What did you do? What sin that took root in the mind of this girl, this monster, to make her turn to us and speak your name? Perhaps it will end as it began, that night with Ojulon's corpse steaming at his feet. In darkness and panic, an unforeseen horror thrust upon him, a child's voice ringing in his ears. But then at least Mektu was unhurt, and Khandri knew a way out, and no search for them had started. They are running in near darkness now, Khandri supporting his brother, avoiding crowds, avoiding lamplight, glancing over their shoulders for the creature that pursues them with calls of, "Lantor! Lantor!" in that drawn-out sing-song voice, as though summoning their father to a game. At times they pull ahead, and the voice disappears. Then a wall or a locked gate stops them cold, and suddenly she is closing. That lambent, stick-thin, dead-eyed girl. From the left or the right or directly behind, never stopping, never blinking, reaching for them like a prize. They pause for breath in an alcove. Each brother studies the other's face, searching for answers, reasons, some least thread to tug. "She thinks one of us is Papa." "I know, I know." They keep the wall in sight, hoping against hope for an open gate. "Him and his fucking secrets," says Mektu. "I hate the old man." "Don't say that. I hope he didn't fake his death. I hope it was real. How could he send us off into the army, knowing that was waiting for us, and not say a thing?" "You'd never do that, Khandri. No decent person would do that. Maybe he didn't know." Mektu shoots him a disgusted look. "That creature knows his first name. She says it like he's her fucking sweetheart." Khandri has no answer. Just weeks before, they had laughed about the old man's ways. But there was no laughter that first night in prison, when his father came to him alone. "Something I should never tell. And if you care about Arikina or your family, you'll never ask me again." So Khandri hadn't. Was he right to keep that silence? To give his trust once more, when the old man so clearly refused to do the same? A flash of light. Sudden shouting. Khandri whirls and sees a red glow above the wall. The cries are from guards along the parapet, gazing down at the plain. "Fun to be had out there as well," says Mektu. "That's not the worst of it," says Khandri. "We're going to be left behind. The others must already be on their way to that hill. Uncle Chindelin won't abandon us." "Uncle Chindelin's not in charge," says Khandri. "And he heard what Black Hat said about being late. He knows it won't do any good to wait for us at Yehida's house. No, he'll go straight to the hermit and expect us to do the same." "Black Hat doesn't much like us, does he?" "Why should he?" says Khandri. "What have we done for him besides..." "Oh, Jashar." The white child has rounded the corner.
"Lantor, I see you."
They run. At least the child does not run. If only they can reach the plains, put miles between them. Did she walk all the way from Eternity Camp? Khandri wonders. Straight over the Iskralim, leading the Rasanga, tracking the brothers like a hound on the scent? No. Impossible. She had not even been aware of them at first. It was only when Khandri gazed at her, when his mind filled with the horror of what he was seeing, that she had sensed him, turned,